Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell has good things to report from Marja in Afghanistan.
The Taliban is clearly being squeezed by our forces, coalition forces, Afghan forces in Afghanistan, being squeezed by Pakistani military and intelligence forces.
After all, Pakistani military operatives captured Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, the Taliban's second-in-command. Signs of a new cooperation between the U.S. and a Pakistani security apparatus reluctant to help. Or maybe not. New reports say it wasn't great intelligence that captured Baradar. Pakistani forces just stumbled on him. In other words, it was luck. We got lucky when we found him. Now we're trying to give Marja a new government and win a war. And that will take a lot more than luck. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 19th. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry this week and here with Celeste Headlee, of course. Celeste, the takeaway on the Baradar story so far is if we thought that we were getting new cooperation from the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence forces, maybe not, but we might have to wait till later to know if there's a new dawn rising with them.
But, you know, there's a lot of luck that plays into everything that goes on in any conflict in
usually
the world.
About luck.
Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. The latest on the Afghan offensive in Marja. Now in its seventh day. At dawn this morning, U.S. helicopters dropped an elite team of Marines behind Taliban lines, part of an effort to break the resistance, which has intensified in parts of the city. NATO says six service members were killed yesterday alone. British Major General Nick Carter, the commander of NATO forces in southern Afghanistan, says it'll be a while before the offensive can be called a complete success.
I guess it will take us another 25 to 30 days to be entirely sure that we have secured that which needs to be secured.
A U.S. general says NATO troops now control the main roads and markets in town.
We're also getting new details about the arrest of the Afghan Taliban's military commander, Mullah Baradar. Our partner, The New York Times, is reporting Baradar was not the target in the raid in which he was captured. U.S. officials are calling it a lucky accident. For the latest on that story, we're joined by New York Times correspondent Rod Nordland in Kabul. Rod, we captured Mullah Baradar. Apparently, there were talks going on, meanwhile, in the Maldives between the Taliban and the Afghan government. Is there an end game developing, or am I just getting ahead of us in Afghanistan?
I think a lucky accident is not an end game. And you know, I think they would like to see this push toward an end game. But Marja is a pretty indecisive encounter. And the only way it will be decisive is after several months they succeed in reestablishing government and services there and make Marja a place that won't fall back in Taliban hands the minute we pull out our troops.
Okay, Marja is an indecisive encounter, and yet we have reports that the Taliban and the Afghan government are talking or starting to talk. Rod Nordland, stay with us because we're going to talk more with you about this in just a few moments.
Here at home, emergency crews have recovered two bodies from the wreckage of an Austin, Texas office building crashed into yesterday by a small plane. One is apparently the pilot, 53-year-old Joseph Stack. And the White House has announced a $1.25 billion settlement with a group of black farmers over a civil rights case that's been around for decades, dealing with the Agriculture Department dragging its feet on loan applications from black farmers.
Moving to the markets now, Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,392. The S&P opens at 1,106. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,241. Coming up, sports movies for the unathletic. We talk about flicks every Friday. And for those who yawn at the Olympics and football, we have some recommendations on how you can be wowed. What sports film do you think you would hate, but it's become one of your favorites?
This is Gretchen in Boston. My favorite sports movie for a non-sports lover would be
Et maintenant sur scène, les triplettes de Belleville.
The Triplets of Belleville, which I see as being about the Tour de France, but not really about the Tour de France.
877-8 my take, or put your suggestions on thetakeaway.org. Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week. And, of course, I'm here with Celeste. Well, we're looking for some benchmarks in Afghanistan this morning. Today marks a week since the offensive in Marja began. Now, that included the capture of some senior Taliban leaders in Pakistan, as we just talked about. The U.S. and Afghan forces are facing remaining Taliban forces in Marja. That fight is apparently intensifying. And a week into the fighting, and with apparently some talks going on between the Taliban and Afghan government officials in the Maldive Islands, according to reports this week, the question is there any kind of endgame developing, or at least a reset of the chessboard to bring us up to speed on not only the fighting in Marja, but also what the larger picture looks like? We're joined back with us, Rob Nordlund. He's foreign correspondent in Kabul for our partner, the New York Times. And also with us is Dr. Nadir Attash, a former Afghan government official and the author of Turbulence, The Tumultuous Journey of One Man's Quest for Change in Afghanistan. Thank you, gentlemen, both for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Rob Nordlund in Kabul, you mentioned at the top that the fight in Marja is far from decisive. Just to start off, would you bring us up to speed on what the latest is in clashes between Afghan and U.S. forces and the Taliban, and where we stand on the takeover of Marja?
Well, it's nearly a week now since the operation began, and they're still doing mopping up. They're still trying to find mines, and they still have scattered firefights and scattered resistance. So that's not over. And they say they are starting to do some civic works, like I think they said they had a couple schools in boxes that they rolled in. They're going to set up almost immediately. But that seems a little premature if there's still shooting going on, which they say there is. But overall, I mean, Marja was pretty small change, and the casualties were very slight, and I mean that's a good thing on the civilian side, but it certainly doesn't indicate that it was the kind of huge offensive that we thought it would be. And it's pretty clear that most of the Taliban just cleared out and didn't bother to stay and fight. So they're still around somewhere.
And clearly living to fight another day, most likely. Well, that begs the question now, Rod Nordlund, I want to ask you, because we had reports this week of talks, surprising talks going on between Taliban officials and Afghan government officials in the Maldive Islands. I use the word endgame, but it suggests at least a contemplation of some form of endgame. How do we square a continuing fight in Marja and what you say is, you know, Taliban fighters living to fight another day and possible negotiations going on?
I don't think the one necessarily flows from the other. I mean, there have been talks at various levels between the Afghan government and the Taliban for quite some time. I mean, the UN representative in Kabul met with some senior Taliban leadership in Dubai. And in fact, there are some reports that one of the people they met in Dubai was Mullah Baradar, and that that if that's the case, you know, his arrest by the Pakistanis may actually not be a good thing for the peace process. Whoever takes his place may not be as willing to at least consider talks as he allegedly was. So it's very unclear now. And I don't really think the Maldives or whatever is happening in talks with the Taliban is a consequence of what's happening in Marja.
Okay, unconnected, says Rod Nordlund. Dr. Nadir Attash, you're a former Afghan government official, and one of the things that Rod Nordlund mentioned is going on in Marja now is the import of some schools in a box. General Stanley McChrystal has mentioned government in a box. Is this strategy the answer to U.S. and Afghan pacification of Marja, do you think?
I don't think so, because I don't think that there is a great deal of credibility to that assertion. If you read the reports from the locals, that assertion was met with sarcasm from the locals, because they said that we had heard that story before. I believe before the offensive of Marja, I think we should have worked on the real issues that job creation, a strong governance, rule of law, corruption, and then I think it would have been easier to capture Marja and other places that are under the insurgents' rule. And I believe the timing is suspect. And also, some people really question the motive of these negotiations, because is it to deflect attention from the real issues, or rather to achieve genuine peace in Afghanistan?
But Nadir Attash, does it at least fill a vacuum, at least in the short term, that might prevent the Taliban that Rod Nordlund says are living to fight another day, prevent them from pouring right back in?
I think if you look at Marja, it's a pretty insignificant place, and I think there was no urgency to capture it right now. So there would be other Marjas. In fact, now we see an increase in the insurgency in the northern parts of Afghanistan, which was pretty stable before. So I don't think that this kind of offensive as a strategy is going to work against a movement like Taliban and other insurgents who are non-Taliban in Afghanistan.
Rod Norland, New York Times correspondent in Kabul. This is the first real offensive since the surge began, since Barack Obama's new strategy is at play in Afghanistan. Is there a difference in the way that the military is behaving in Marja, whether the city itself is insignificant? Is this a good, significant example of a new approach to the Afghanistan war?
Well, certainly they have a new approach, and in terms of the way they're fighting, they're doing a lot more to keep civilian casualties down, and they've succeeded in doing that. There's been only 15 confirmed cases of civilians killed in the last week. If you compare that to Fallujah, in the first week there were some 800 civilians killed. So certainly it's a different approach. Whether that's one that's going to make defeating the Taliban any quicker or easier is very much very much in doubt. And I agree with what your other guest said about Marja being a fairly insignificant place. There's been a huge amount of hoopla around it. It's the first big offensive since the Afghan surge in a new administration and so on. But at the end of the day, it's not terribly important. Even in Helmand, in terms of Helmand province, it's the last big populated place that the Taliban control. But controlling large population areas is not what an insurgency needs to do to stay alive.
Well, we'll see what comes of this action in Marja. Rod Nordland, New York Times correspondent in Kabul, and Dr. Nadir Attash, former Afghan official, thank you both for joining us this morning.
The conversation continues at thetakeaway.org. Leave a comment now.
Now let's check in on some of our top stories at 15 minutes past the hour.
At the Winter Games in Vancouver, the U.S. took 4 medals yesterday, including a gold by men's figure skater Evan Lysacek.
Oh, I had so much fun tonight. I mean, I couldn't have asked for much more than that to have my personal best in the most important moment of my life. You know, I've just dreamed about it.
The U.S. also won 2 medals for women's snowboarding and 1 for ladies' alpine skiing. Sticking with sports, golf's biggest star, that would be Tiger Woods, will make his first public appearance since his sex scandal hit on Thanksgiving. He'll be making a statement at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, but he'll take no questions from reporters. And in other news, President Obama will give $1.5 billion to the 5 states hit hardest by the housing crisis. That's Arizona, California, Michigan, Florida, and Nevada. They've seen their home prices drop by 20% or more. The president will make the announcement later today in Las Vegas. That's the city with the worst foreclosure crisis in the nation.
In Japan, Toyota's president Akio Toyoda says he will testify at a congressional hearing next week about the country's worldwide safety recalls. Turning to Haiti, the UN says it needs more money for relief efforts. It's now asking for nearly $1.5 billion. That's more than double its initial request. UN Special Envoy President Bill Clinton says the donations will help survivors rebuild.
If you really want them to become what they can become, we have to get them out of living day to day. We can't do it without your help.
The latest UN appeal for donations is the largest it has ever made for a natural disaster. And that's a look at some of the stories we've been watching this morning. Coming up, we talk about the Olympics and the gold medal victory for skater Evan Lysacek. More on that story in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
And we have takeouts for you this morning on stories we're following this week. The Federal Reserve raised the interest rate that it charges on short-term loans to banks yesterday. Here to explain is Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Possibly an indication that they believe the economy is getting better. Louise, did they tell us why they decided to raise interest rates?
So, Celeste, they've been telling us for a while they were going to raise this rate. It's not just the rate they charge banks. It's the rate they charge banks for emergency borrowing. This is an emergency window, and they lowered the rate here in August 07 as the crisis was brewing. At the height of the crisis in the fall of 08, banks were borrowing about $100 billion through this discount window. Now we're down to them borrowing less than $15 billion because it's not such an emergency. They don't need to borrow as much from the Fed.
So is the average American going to see any difference in the interest rates they pay on things?
So this rate, particularly when this window is not being used, this rate does not pass through to other borrowing as much as the federal fund rates, which is the main rate people talk about with the Fed. That's expected to be raised also later on. Hasn't happened yet. But this is all the Fed exiting from these things they did during the crisis. They pulled a lot of levers, and now they're just putting them back in place. It was widely expected.
Okay, Louise Story, thanks so much. Finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
Now on to sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Speaking of the window, Tiger Woods has snatched the drape shut since the window was thrown open on his private life and his affairs with numerous women. Tiger Woods appears in front of the cameras for the first time today at 11, Ibrahim, since the scandal broke. Now, he's not going to be taking questions from reporters, but you have some questions you would like to be able to ask Tiger Woods.
Without a doubt, and it's not a secret that Tiger Woods is not well-liked. He's aloof and he's very controlling. But this is one of the things that I want to know. Why did you do it? You have a beautiful wife. You have beautiful kids. Why did you mess that up? And I think that's what a lot of people want to know. What on earth were you thinking,
Tiger?
Might
be asking himself that.
Precisely.
Okay.
Another one is, when are you coming back to golf? Hello, Tiger. You're the best golfer in the world. Please come back to golf. Put some of this stuff to rest. And there's a lot of people who are saying it's none of our damn business. And he doesn't need to apologize. Get back to golf and make that clear. And finally, are you more sorry that you were a cheater or that you were caught? Because that's the real question that people want to know.
Good question.
Are you really sorry that you were caught? And deep down, we want to know that Tiger, we want him to answer questions because we want to see him as a human being. So I think he's got a long way to go to win back the trust of his fans and of his potential economic supporters.
Now, what about question number two? When are you going to come back to golf? What are the signs of when he's coming back? When is he going to play? Do we know?
Some people think that this sort of announcing it at a PGA event is sort of a harbinger that he is perhaps thinking about in that direction, and maybe at Augusta he'll make his return. So we're hoping that he'll be able to, you know, play in some of the Masters and sort of put some of this behind him. I think he should go on Oprah before that, or like a Barbara Walters special.
The Oprah couch.
Right, exactly, and sort of deal with some of those issues there.
Right. All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks. And before you go, Ibrahim, he wants us to point out the USA plays Canada on Sunday in Olympic hockey. It's a huge game. So after you get your Tiger overdose, reset for Sunday Olympic hockey.
Our last takeout, we go to Vancouver. We're joined by Jason Stallman. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Jason, there's a lot of attention on men's figure skating in this Olympics. It's considered to be one of the most competitive fields for the sport this year. What happened last night?
Absolutely, it was one of the most competitive fields, and I think what happened last night caught a lot of people by surprise. Yevgeny Plyshenko, the defending Olympic champion from Russia, he performs a move called the quad that not many people dare to try, four full rotations. He pulled it off seemingly flawlessly last night, but Evan Lysacek of the United States somehow passed him up. Lysacek had most of his jumps in the second half of his program, and he was rewarded bonus points for that. Because, you know, the judges say if you're doing this late in your program, if you're doing your jumps late in your program, it's more difficult.
Because you're
and
tired.
That seemed to be the difference.
Yeah, it's a long program, and people get tired.
4.5 minutes, you should be completely exhausted by the end of it. And Lysacek was able to do most of his difficult moves toward the end, and that seemed to pay off.
So where are the standings now?
Well, Lysacek walks away with a gold medal,
yep.
And Plyshenko takes a silver, and Daisuke Takashini of Japan leaves Vancouver with Asia's first medal in men's figure skating at the Olympic level.
So what happened to Johnny Weir?
Johnny Weir seemed to skate great. The fans really, really embraced him, and he was thrilled with his performance. He had a crown of red roses on his head in the kiss and cry area after his routine. He finished fifth.
And he was happy with that.
He seemed to be thrilled.
How did the audience feel?
The audience was into it. You know, they especially got into Evgeny Plyshenko's routine. He's not typically somebody who really tries to engage the live audience, and he did that last night. So watching his performance, it was hard not to think that he had it locked up. He was making eye contact. He was nodding and thrusting his hips at the audience, and they were eating it up. And when he finished his performance, he seemed to think it was locked up. The audience seemed to, but But no, Lysacek walks away with the gold.
Don't count your gold medals until they're hung about your neck, right, Jason?
Absolutely.
Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. It is Friday, and lots of people are going to be watching Olympics over the weekend, but a lot of people are also going to be going to the movies. So our question that we're asking listeners today is about sports movies. I don't particularly like sports movies, and I'm always surprised when I like them. So we're asking listeners, were there movies that you ended up loving that you thought you were going to hate? Todd, was there?
I wasn't supposed to like it. I didn't want to like it, but I love it. Titanic.
Okay.
Love it.
Interesting. Ibrahim?
As a longtime comic books fan, I didn't think I was going to like Spider-Man, but I did love it.
You loved Spider-Man. And Louise, any movies you expected
to
hate?
The Big Lebowski. Ugh, I thought I would hate it, but now I get all those jokes about the dude.
Now
I get,
you get it.
I'm in the conversation.
Now you abide.
The dude, I get it.
Did your husband have to explain some of them?
He did, but now I'm on the same page as the rest of society. I get it. The dude.
Louise abides.
We want to hear from you. Was there a film you expected to hate and you ended up loving it? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, how would welcoming the Dalai Lama to the White House, what kind of manners are involved in that? And when you have a handshake, does that handshake mean something different in Tibet than it does in China? We're going to talk about diplomacy and the secret codes involved in how you behave in just a few minutes. Coming up, the Dalai Lama dropped by the White House yesterday.
I always admire America, mainly as a champion of democracy.
You know, there's a secret symbolic language in diplomacy that governs the relationships between countries. And if you were fluent in that language, you'd know that what the Dalai Lama was saying there was that, well, he thinks America's a champion of democracy, but we're going to find out about other decoded language.
Meaning.
Yes, layers upon layers in just a few minutes. First, here's some of the other news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. The fight is turning deadlier in the Afghan city of Marja. On the seventh day of the offensive, NATO troops ran into snipers and well-fortified Taliban positions. NATO says six service members were killed yesterday alone. The Afghan defense minister tells the BBC.
Physically on the battlefield, we are ahead of the Allied forces in the operation.
A U.S. general says NATO troops now control the main roads and markets in town. We're also getting word this morning that the Afghan Taliban's second-in-command, Mullah Baradar, and two other high-value militants may get deported to Afghanistan, but they will not be turned over to U.S. custody. This comes as our partner, The New York Times, is reporting Baradar was not the target in the raid in which he was captured. U.S. officials are calling it a lucky accident.
The Army is planning to speed up the destruction of chemical weapons facilities in Colorado and Kentucky by blowing them up. Officials say the plan is to use explosives and that it's perfectly safe. The U.S. has a 2012 deadline to get rid of a stockpile of mustard gas and other weapons. President Obama may be coming to a high school graduation near you. The White House is holding a contest for top-performing schools, and according to the White House, the winner gets the president at their graduation. Now let's see how the markets are reacting. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,392. The S&P opens at 1,106, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,241. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Yesterday, Barack Obama complicated U.S.-China relations by welcoming the Dalai Lama to the White House. Now, granted, the Dalai Lama was in the map room, not the Oval Office, and that's a secret code. That means it wasn't as important a meeting as if they'd met in the Oval Office, but you have to know the code in order to interpret it properly. To explain all this sort of diplomatic code language, we have David Banks with us. David says diplomats in the West see meetings like yesterday's very differently from diplomats in the East. Good morning, David, and welcome to The Takeaway.
Good morning.
So there's this ritualistic language that's involved in diplomacy. Can you kind of give us some examples of things which maybe are not spoken, unspoken, handshakes or photo ops that mean something important on the global stage?
Yeah, there's a lot of conventions internationally that are understood by diplomats and foreign offices as sort of a tea leaf, sort of codes you can read. And so things like very often you'll see there's jockeying for position or discussions over things like seating arrangements at meetings, where people stand on dioceses, podiums, who speaks first, who enters a room first. Now, these things are kind of, they're not very important to ordinary people, but these are the kind of things that you find diplomats obsessing over sometimes.
Well, David, you're actually a doctoral researcher in what's called ritual and symbolic diplomacy. Can you explain the symbolic diplomacy, the diplomacy that goes on in terms of symbols? I mean, does it matter what people wear? Does it matter how low they bow, as we saw in Japan?
Actually, yeah, the Japan example is an excellent example of this. So It does matter, is the short of it. And it matters a great deal for states' sense of the sort of prestige or honor. So in Obama's instance in Japan, what happened there was that according to diplomatic protocol at the international level, you're expected to observe the welcoming traditions of the host country. So President Obama didn't actually do anything unusual or especially strange when he bowed in front of the emperor. In fact, the only strange thing is he also shook his hand, which you're not supposed to do in Japan. So he just kind of confused the ritual rather than actually mess it up. What's interesting, though, is, of course, that that's the international language of symbols, but the domestic language of symbols in the U.S. is different. So that was construed by a great deal of great many people in the U.S. as being a sort of a submissive move on Obama's part, which at the international level, it wouldn't be interpreted like that at all.
So, David Banks, this is Todd Zwillick here. How you doing?
Hi, how are you?
David, so in the events of yesterday, translate for us, President Obama meets with the Dalai Lama, okay, but as Celeste said, meets with the Dalai Lama in the map room of the White House, not in the Oval Office. What does that mean in American? What does that mean in Chinese?
Right. Well, so firstly, I've got to caveat the point by saying that the meaning, symbolic meanings are never fully clear, which is part of the power that they have. It lets countries sort of state things or infer things without actually having to say them out loud. But I will give you my translation of what I would think he's trying to say. I think that by President Obama meeting the Dalai Lama in the White House, this is a symbol that American domestic audiences can understand quite clearly. It means, you know, this is an important figure for us, and the Dalai Lama has got a sort of huge symbolic association with human rights, so that domestic audiences in the U.S. can understand this quite clearly. At the international level, so for international audiences and certainly for the Chinese administration, for the way they should read this is, yes, the Dalai Lama matters to us, but look, we're not suggesting he's the leader of Tibet, because if he was the leader of Tibet, we'd bring him into the Oval Office and not the map room. So we're bringing him into the map room because we're trying to say, yes, he matters, but maybe you shouldn't worry too much. And it should be noted that, as far as I can find out about this, the Chinese were quite concerned about exactly who would be meeting in the room, would the First Lady be there, and all this kind of stuff. And I think it speaks volumes that the Obama administration didn't allow the press to be there, that they released their own photos, because this way it means they can very much control the symbolic message they're trying to convey.
Well, did it mean something different to the Tibetans?
Unfortunately, I don't know how this is playing out at all in Tibet or in China, and I don't know enough really about how the kind of medias operate in those countries. But I think the point that I'm trying to make is that symbols, they don't actually speak for themselves, and what they really require is interpreters. And so this means that symbolic language can be interpreted different ways by different audiences, which is what happened with President Obama in Japan, and is also what I think consciously the White House were trying to do yesterday.
Well, you know, for the average person who's never going to have to worry about whether how low they bow to the emperor in Japan or whether or not they host the Dalai Lama in the map room or the Oval Office, it seems to me like this kind of symbolic ritual language actually comes into play all the time for all of us. I was thinking about, like, in the Da Vinci Code, all the codes that painters used to put into their paintings, or even when you go to Thanksgiving dinner or a wedding, where you place people at a wedding table matters. I mean, manners matter.
Yeah, they do matter. I mean, they absolutely do, and that's certainly what I'm interested in terms of the research. I think the problem with symbolic language is, like I said a second ago, is it's not actually the meaning is not inherent in the symbols themselves. We associate meaning with symbols, but it's completely in our own social context. So flags have certain meanings, or historical traditions have certain meanings in the U.S. that they don't have in other countries, and vice versa. So in terms of can you use this as a guide in your life, you need to know what the conventions are first, and then especially if the other person knows that you should know the conventions and then you don't follow them, that's when I think you start to see problems. I think when people aren't expected to know, then people don't mind.
But is it okay to do in diplomacy what we do in real life, which is to talk about it and say, oh, whoops, gosh, I really didn't mean that. I'm so sorry.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. But not if, like I said, it's assumed that you should have known beforehand. So very often world leaders who aren't especially savvy in these codes themselves might meet and do something, okay, and that would be ignored. But if they were had met with their foreign officer, the protocol officer beforehand, and then did it, I think most other countries would assume there was a certain amount of intentional insult going on there.
So no forgiveness for ignorance there. Davy Banks is a doctoral researcher on ritual and symbolic diplomacy at George Washington University. Coming up, we're going to talk about sports movies for the unathletic.
The only thing I'm afraid of is wasting the rest of my life with you guys.
I thought that was the whole plan.
We're going to talk about flicks as we do every single Friday. And if you don't like sports, if you're one of those people that especially don't like to watch movies about sports, we have some recommendations on how you can enjoy sports in the cinema, from Breaking Away to more. We're going to talk about that later this hour. And we're also asking that as our question for you today. Our takeaway question is, was there ever a movie, it doesn't even matter if it's about sports, was there a movie that you went into thinking you were going to hate it? Maybe somebody else dragged you to the movie theater and then you ended up loving it? Todd's is the Titanic.
One of them, yeah.
Yeah. But what's yours? 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post a comment to thetakeaway.org.
It really is a great movie, I have to say. You guys are making fun of me. It's a fine, fine
film. I'm not making fun of you. I just didn't like it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The Obama administration announced a $1.25 billion settlement yesterday, resolving a decades-long fight by thousands of black farmers. The farmers say the Agriculture Department discriminated against them in loan programs, sometimes forcing them to lose their farms. Each farmer who qualifies for the settlement now would get $50,000. Joining us is John Boyd, Jr., president and founder of the National Black Farmers Association. Mr. Boyd, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on your show.
A pleasure. Now, you've been working on this settlement, as I understand it, for about 20 years. So what does this announcement of $1.25 billion mean to you this morning?
Well, this is a very historic announcement for African Americans across the country. This will put $50,000 into eligible black farmers' hands who've been waiting to receive this compensation for over a decade. I began lobbying Congress and the year 2000 to secure the funding.
How many farmers are we talking about?
We're talking about 80,000 black farmers in 42 states.
80,000
that'd be eligible for the funding.
All across the country now.
All across the country, and this is the second time that the measure has been proposed by the Obama administration in the budget. Although yesterday was the agreement where the Agriculture Department, the Justice Department, and the farmers all agreed to a set amount and a procedural process to begin to process the payments for the black farmers.
Now, $50,000 sounds pretty good, but it doesn't sound like a whole lot, frankly, for somebody who lost their family farm.
No, it's not.
Okay, so how far does it go, do you think?
NPR. Yes, I tell you, if we can just it's not a lot of money. It won't bring your farm back or anything like
right.
that. But we certainly, for a farmer who can't pay his light bill or phone bill, it will certainly help, you know. So this is a long time coming for black farmers, and we really need for Congress to act and appropriate the funds so that the black farmers can finally receive their payment.
And there are still windows of opportunity, as I understand it, for a judge to potentially stave this off, or is it just up to Congress now?
Well, I think there was discussions with the judge who I think looks at the settlement very favorable. I don't think Judge Freeman will object to the settlement at all. I don't see that in the future.
This isn't the first time, though, that a settlement has been announced, right? This group of farmers that you're talking about in 42 states is sort of a second round of farmers who didn't get settlements the first time.
Yes, we filed the original lawsuit in 97. It was finalized by consent decree in 1999, and 14,000 black farmers received the $50,000. And the Justice Department, the United States Department of Agriculture and the Justice Department filed motions in federal court to deny us the names of all the farmers that were eligible. And that's why many of the black farmers missed the filing deadline. So 80,000 black farmers came after the filing deadline. And that brings us to, you know, where we are today. We've been fighting for a very long time to get those cases heard. And the black farmers deserve it because the Agriculture Department treated black farmers worse than dirt, the way they treated us in the farm lending program. And thanks for that. Yes.
All right. Okay. Well, John Boyd, I should probably let you run there because you definitely have a lot going on, and it's a big day for you. John Boyd, Jr., president of and founder of the National Black Farmers Association, a group that exists largely for the news that we're hearing today, a settlement in a decades-long case between black farmers and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a $1.25 billion settlement announced today for farmers who lost their farms because of discrimination, $50,000 each.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, we're going to talk about movies, and this week we're going to talk about sports movies everybody can love, even the people who think they don't like sports movies. And so here's our trivia question for today, and it's about sports movies. Sports stars, they make lots of cameo appearances in movies, so can you tell us the movies that are associated with the following athletes? In what movies did these athletes appear? Number one, Lance Armstrong. Number 2, Mike Tyson. And number 3, Anna Kournikova. Know the answer? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or you can post at thetakeaway.org.
Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Some economic news just in. Consumer prices, excluding food and energy, fell in January. The AP says it's the first monthly drop in 27 years. The U.S. racked up 4 more medals at the Olympics yesterday, including a gold in men's figure skating. But U.S. alpine skier Lindsey Vonn wasn't one of the winners. She fell during the slalom event.
I just was fighting hard and I hooked a tip. It happens in slalom, and I was hoping that it wasn't going to happen today, but I gave it my best. I skied well on the downhill, and I thought I was skiing well on the top of the slalom, but just wasn't my day.
Vonn says she's going to rest for the rest of the day and get her injured leg ready for tomorrow's events, the Super G and the Giant Slalom remain. The head of the world's richest stem cell research fund has told the BBC he expects a cure for diabetes in less than a decade. Professor Alan Trousen of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine says research in mice is encouraging. It shows that human stem cells can be turned into insulin-producing cells to treat diabetes.
In Iran, state TV says the country has just launched a new battleship in the Gulf. It's a destroyer loaded with sophisticated radar and anti-ship missiles. Last month, the U.S. said it was monitoring Iran's growing missile threat. And finally, here at home, Bernie Kerik, New York City's police commissioner during the September 11th attacks, has been sentenced to 4 years in prison. He was convicted of 8 felonies yesterday, including filing false taxes and lying. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Movie Fridays on The Takeaway. Today's movie segment is dedicated to all you people out there who frankly couldn't care less about the Olympics or the Super Bowl for that matter, but are forced to live in a world where everyone else does. Our theme, sports movies for people who don't like sports. Sports movies that even a nerd could love, maybe. Chris Ryan from RollingStones.com is an expert in the area. Nerd or movie critic, or maybe both. He's seen a lot of movies and a lot of sports movies, and he knows which ones are for sports fans only and which ones you can enjoy even if you really and truly hate the sports but you love film. And why would you hate sports? I guess that's for another segment,
right?
Team sports not so much for me, the individual ones I can get into. But Chris, just to start off, what makes a sports movie palatable for the sports hater? When does the sports not really matter?
I think the rule of thumb that you really have to follow here is the sport going to be central to the movie? Is that going to be the main character? So if your enjoyment of the film winds up hinging on whether or not a team or an athlete wins at the end, then you're probably going to be disappointed. Also, you want to avoid those sports movies that are really overdone with a lot of the rules of the game or the intricacies or details of a certain sport. So say a movie like Hoosiers is probably going to be disappointing because Hoosiers is about basketball.
Right.
Whether
they win or lose.
Exactly.
And
that, you know, the entire film is dedicated to the coaching of basketball, the playing of basketball, what basketball means to a community, et cetera.
You know, that reminds me of Dodgeball. Dodgeball was really about dodgeball. There
yes.
was a scene where they went through the rules. They explained what happens when you catch a ball, get hit by a ball, that you have to dip, dive, duck, dodge, and dive.
Yes.
You know, that movie was all about dodgeball and nothing else.
Yeah, it's sort of the bizarro version of Hoosiers, I suppose.
Right, very bizarro. I think that movie was about nothing, not even dodgeball. It was just about a cheap laugh. Well, Chris, you and our producer, Kristen Meisner, have made a list of your top 10 movies for people who – sports movies for people who hate sports. Listeners, of course, you all can go on the website at thetakeaway.org and vote for your favorites or nominate your own. I just want to walk through a couple of these with you. Chris, your first pick was Blades of Glory.
Yeah.
Chaz Michael Michaels, an ice-devouring sex tornado spawned in the hellfires of Motown.
Troubled childhood? If you call being a 9-year-old kid with a 35-year-old girlfriend troubled.
Blades of Glory?
Yeah, well, Blades of Glory, I think this is for all our newfound Evan Lysacek fans out there. It's a great lampoon of our obsession with biographies. Or when you're watching the Olympics these days, I'm sure everybody's got their story they have to tell. Well, the stories in Blades of Glory are absolutely ridiculous. It's about the first male-male figure skating duo. It's
right.
Played by Will Ferrell and John Heder from Napoleon Dynamite. It's got incredible villains played by Will Arnett and Amy Poehler, and it's just a great satire of the campy world of figure skating as well as sort of macho homophobia.
And in a way, it was sort of the dodgeball of the figure skating
yes.
world. I know I'm obsessing over dodgeball, but let me have a moment of honesty. I love that movie. All right, here's another clip from your list, Chris.
Hell, I don't want to go to college, Dad. To hell with them.
What, are you afraid?
little bit.
What are we listening to there?
Well, that's Breaking Away. It's a 70s coming-of-age film starring Dennis Quaid and Dennis Christopher.
Around cycling.
Yes, and it's sort of like a Bruce Springsteen song come to life if you replace 67 Chevys with Italian bicycles. It's about a bunch of kids living in Bloomington who are trying to get out of their hometown while still sort of embracing the qualities that make it great.
So you've described that a sports movie for a non-sports lover shouldn't be directly about the sports. It should be incidental.
Like, right.
It could take place in an office, for
sure,
instance.
Sure, exactly. I think that that's a great movie in any case. I mean, you want to have a film where you can transpose the plot into any kind of setting, but you'd still have the same sort of qualities for the story. So if you took an office or a workplace comedy, but you could also transpose it onto sports, you could transpose it into whatever, it would still succeed.
Let me toss a couple of these at you.
Sure.
From the world of baseball, for instance, you tell me if you think these sports movies fit into your template for good sports movies for non-sports lovers. So a movie like Bull Durham strikes me that it's about romance. It's a little bit about baseball, but not so much.
Well, yeah, in Bull Durham, I think the baseball is more of a metaphor, whereas, you know, something like The Natural, I think even though that's also a metaphorical
Robert
film,
Redford.
Too. That's very much about whether or not he succeeds as a baseball player. Bull Durham's about whether or not they succeed as a couple.
All right, Bull Durham is Kevin Costner. Kevin Costner also in Field of Dreams.
Yes. Which is another film where I think that you don't have to love baseball to love that movie. It's about loving something so much that you can't give it. It's about faith and hope and loving something so much that you can't give up a dream.
I'm a hockey fan and a former resident of Montreal, Canada, so I have to ask about a favorite of college kids from all across Canada, Slapshot, starring Paul Newman. It's a pretty hockey-heavy movie, but a big comedy. Can you love Slapshot if you don't love hockey?
I'd say you could love Slapshot if you love profanity. It's maybe one of the funniest movies ever made, and it's also one of the most profane movies ever made.
Let us not forget about the Hansen brothers,
no,
right?
Of course, yeah.
Putting on the foil to
yes.
start a fight. That's Slapshot with Paul Newman. Chris Ryan is a freelance writer. He writes for Spin and for RollingStone.com, joining us in the studio to talk about sports movies that even you sports haters can love during the Olympics and in the aftermath of the Super Bowl.
Okay, so Chris, we have this trivia question for you. You know, sports stars often make appearances in movies, and so we're asking you, in which movies did the following athletes appear? Number one, Lance Armstrong.
I am wrong, but I am going to say There's Something About Mary.
You are wrong. It's actually the movie that Todd loves. It's Dodgeball.
Okay.
Aren't you Peter LaFleur?
Lance Armstrong?
Yeah, that's me. No, but I'm a big fan of yours.
Really?
Yeah, I've been watching the Dodgeball tournament on the Ocho.
That was Brett Favre, who was in Something About Mary.
Yeah. Anna Kournikova.
I have no idea.
She was actually the motel manager in Me, Myself, and Irene. And the last one for you, Mike Tyson.
That would be The Hangover.
Mike Tyson? This is my favorite part coming up right now. I can feel it coming in the air tonight.
You're close, my guy.
All right, Chris Ryan from Spin and RollingStone.com. Thanks for joining us. We've got Chris's list of good sports movies and non-sports movies for watchers on our website where you can vote for your favorite and suggest your own. Stop by thetakeaway.org for that. Now, what's a sports film you thought you would hate and now has become one of your favorites? How about a film about curling?
I can trace my lineage back through 12 generations of curling men. And even if Yount is gracious in defeat, his shiny suits and lumpen cheerleaders represent all that is corrupt in God's greatest game. I thank you, James Lennox. Your debt is erased. James Lennox.
Curling dramatized. Louise posts to our Facebook page, Men with Brooms with Paul Gross. Curling doesn't get much better than that.
Larry from Brooklyn. The movie I didn't think I was going to like was another Coen Brothers movie, Raising Arizona.
Where's Junior?
What do you mean? Didn't you put him in?
No, I thought.
I didn't think you could make a comedy about kidnapping, but they did it.
It's Paul from Parsippany, New Jersey. Sports movies that I didn't expect much of that totally blew me away. The Replacements.
I know you're tired. I know you're hurting. And I wish I could say something that was classy and inspirational, but that just wouldn't be our style.
I went out and bought it, wash it 3-4 times a year. It moves me every time.
Pain heals. Chicks dig scars. Glory lasts forever.
That's Keanu Reeves. Give us your take on 8778MYTAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. We've been talking about movies you expected to hate and didn't ended up liking. For me, Dumb and Dumber. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
Teen-year-old college students? Absolutely.
I totally wish they would have done that when I was in high school. I hated high school. I was bored.
And here's an encouraging fact. In a recent study, early college high schools had a graduation rate of 92%. But these are schools where kids earn college credit while they're still in high school. What happens when they get that diploma and head out on their own?
High school is like the state of the nation. Some people never change after graduation.
I feel like there are a lot of programs to get these kids into college early, but I don't think that there's as many programs to support them once they finish. I think that the job market just isn't ready for these kids, and they're barely even ready for the kids that graduate at a regular age.
We all seem to have strong opinions on this issue, and it's all complicated by our memories of the prom.
I know I'll be graduating early.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 19th. I'm here with Todd Zwillick. And the takeaway for me is, you know, I got college credit while I was in high school, and I felt extremely mature at age 16 and 17.
You felt mature.
I felt very mature, but my college years argue otherwise.
Right, and that could be the difference doing college credit versus in high school versus going off to a school somewhere else when you're 16. I don't know. Well, let's get to some of the other, to the top stories we're following this morning. 7 days in, the battle for Afghanistan in Marja rages on. NATO says six service members were killed yesterday alone as U.S. and Afghan troops ran into snipers and well-fortified Taliban positions. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dr. Nadir Attash, a former Afghan government official, who told us even if we run the Taliban out of Marja, they'll just turn up somewhere else.
Now we see an increase in the insurgency in the northern parts of Afghanistan, which was pretty stable before.
You can hear that interview on our website, thetakeaway.org. We're also getting new details about the arrest of the Afghan Taliban's military commander, Mullah Baradar. Our partner, The New York Times, is reporting Baradar was not the target in the raid in which he was captured. U.S. officials are calling it instead a lucky accident.
Here at home, the White House has announced a $1.25 billion settlement with a group of black farmers over a civil rights case that's been around for decades. And yesterday we talked about a new initiative giving high school students the option of placing out of their senior year and going straight to college. We're going to talk more about this because we had a strong response from listeners. Valerie Purdy Vons joins us now. She's professor of psychology at Columbia University. Valerie, is there a distinction between a student who's academically ready to leave high school and a student who is mature enough to deal with college?
Yeah, I think that there is. And I think that a lot of times people are taking not enough account of the psychological component. Academically, you can have the grades. You can even financially, your parents, it's a great opportunity to go on to community college. Emotionally, even financially, do you have a credit card? What is the college doing for you? What, you're taking a bus. Everyone else is driving. All these things create differences. The second thing is that people think of college as this wonderful place, but it's extremely isolating in your first year when you're trying to make friends. Who wants to be friends with a 16-year-old or a 15-year-old compared to particularly in community colleges where the average age of students are 20 and 21? So the gap is huge there.
We're going to talk more about this with Valerie Purdy Vons in just a moment. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down as well. The Dow starts at 10,392. The S&P opens at 1,106 and the NASDAQ at 2241. Coming up, Malcolm X was assassinated 45 years ago this weekend. We're going to take a look at his legacy through some rediscovered tape of his voice, not heard since the 1960s.
We're also talking about movies this morning and getting wowed by movies you never thought would be good. What's a sports film that you thought you would hate and now has become one of your favorites?
Hi, it's Alan from Boston. One of the best movies ever made, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner.
Running's always been a big thing in our family, especially running away from the police. It's hard to understand. All I know is that you've got to run. That's what the loneliness of the long-distance runner feels like.
8778-MY-TAKE. You can post your favorites on the website, thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Todd Zwillick. And we talked yesterday about a new initiative that gives high school students the option to place out of their senior year, sometimes even their junior year, and go straight on to college. This sparked a lively debate among our listeners.
This is
Peter calling from Newton, Massachusetts. I know it had its ups and downs for me and for my own kids, but I don't think they should be encouraging kids to move on faster. There's a lot of growing up to do.
Heard from a lot of people who said they hated high school and would have liked to make it shorter, but is that a reason to move from high school to college? We've got the answers today from Joseph Harris. He's the director of the National High School Center, a research initiative that's funded by the U.S. Department of Education. And also Valley Prettyvon rejoins us. She's a psychology professor at Columbia University. So, Joseph, let me start with you. This idea of moving on, or at least doing college coursework early, is not a new one. That's been around for a long time. I got a lot of college coursework done while I was in high school by taking AP tests and a couple college classes.
Yes, that is correct. In fact, it's been around probably for more than 20 years. My own son took college-level courses in the early 1980s.
But there's a distinction here because some of these programs are ones in which they stay in a high school setting and they get college credits. But then there's some people who are talking about just allowing kids to leave high school after their 10th grade year and move on to a community college. That's a different thing.
Well, there's actually a cross between the two. A very popular program over the last few years have been what are called middle college high schools or early college high schools, in which there are courses offered in a kind of a nested setting within a community college so that students are bused in and spend the day at the community college and then are bused back to their local high schools. So it's really not an either-or situation. There can be opportunities for students to take college-level courses on college campuses, and those have been around and have been tested over many years.
Here's an issue that I have with this, and that's that the statistics tell us that half of kids in college change their majors, half of them, and 40% don't finish a degree by the time they've been in college for 6 years. So if we're talking about a period of a time of life where kids really are changing so rapidly that they're not going to be the same person at 16, 17, 18 that is they are at 20, why should we be rushing them into it?
Well, I think, again, remembering this isn't not necessarily for every student that's out there. Some of the reasons that those kids take longer and take up to 6 years is that there's a growing number of students who are going into college that that need some type of remediation to be brought up to speed to be able to do college-level courses. One of the things that's proposed in this new approach is the use of screening tests to make sure that kids have the college and career-ready skills before they even attempt to take a college-level course.
Okay, but that's not the reason why a lot of people say they want to go. This is one of our listeners who called from South Florida.
This is Eric calling from South Florida. I almost dropped out of high school in ninth grade because I wanted to get into college so badly. Luckily, in South Florida, they have this thing called the School for Advanced Studies that allows you to start college as part of dual enrollment half-time in 11th grade. And graduate with enough credits to have an associate's degree and then go on to regular college. So, yeah, I think it should be definitely an option nationwide.
Valerie Prettyvon, is it better in terms of a transition when we keep them within a high school setting and allow them to take advanced courses?
I think that there are clear psychological issues in terms of having a cohort of students. There's also the other issue. There's a great finding in psychology called the big fish in the little pond effect, showing that student achievement is better when you have students that are at the top of their class in a lower tier group than at the bottom of the class in a higher tier group. And there's clear evidence related to grades and so forth. So what I see in terms of that is, you know, really, I'm not clear about what the screening process is for these students who are going into the community college, but they're clearly going to be the ones that are the little fish in the big pond.
Well, you heard Joseph Harris talking about this has to be something that's individually evaluated. This is a shame.
I actually started taking some community college classes when I was 16, and I was able to finish a whole year ahead of all my other friends who went out to universities and everything. So I think it's great. It's a great program, but it all depends on the student and if they can handle it.
What kind of student, Valerie, would best benefit from something like this?
One of the things that I think would be great is not just one student, but a small cohort of students. So certainly these sort of small nested settings, but also two or three peers going together to take courses, I think, are better. Because, again, for college students, they don't necessarily want to befriend a high school student. So, you know, one is emotional maturity. Two are parents not thinking that their 16-year-old is really in college and they really have hands off. They actually need to be more hands-on at that point. So I think it's really a dynamic between the parents and the student, and then also trying to get at least some kind of small cohort so these 16, 15-year-olds are not so isolated in community colleges.
Joseph Harris, for these students, when they actually end up in college, when they've left their advanced studies courses and are in a community college at the age of 16, what kind of structures do we need to have in place so that these kids don't get isolated, so that they're not dealing with 21-year-olds and having to deal with drinking and maybe getting involved in sexual issues that they may have been possibly more protected from in high school?
Well, I think Valerie raises a good point. I think having ensuring there are cohort opportunity, you know, cohorts that students can be part of where they can identify with other students who are in similar situations is a good remedy to that problem.
Okay, I want to play one more clip from a listener. This is Mimi.
This is Mimi from Michigan, and I have a 16-year-old daughter who takes honors classes. She would be a wonderful candidate for entrance into early college. That's the only thing she doesn't really understand about high school is the hoopla about adolescence.
Valerie Prettyvons, this raises an issue for me, which is that high school students are not always the best judges of how mature they are. Parents aren't always the best judges of whether their kid would get into trouble or what they can handle. And administrators are sometimes compromised because they're trying to save on their budgets. So who judges whether a student's ready academically and in maturity?
So this is a place where I think quite a bit of research needs to be done. I certainly think that there's a certain type of student that may benefit. Certainly students who are ostracized in high school may benefit. Certainly students who may be at risk and high school is not a great environment may benefit. But I certainly think, again, it's an interaction between the parents, the students, and creating some kind of cohort where they'll be safe in these community colleges. But certainly this is an area where more research needs to be done in terms of what kind of profile of student will benefit.
Okay, Valerie Prettyvons is a professor of psychology at Columbia University, and Dr. Joseph Harris, both of them doctors, Joseph Harris is the director of the National High School Center, which is a federally funded technical assistance center out of D.C. Keep the conversation going. Our listeners have lots to say on this. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
At the Olympics today, the ice dance event is on the agenda. American ice dancer Ben Agosto says the competition is wide open.
There isn't one kind of standout leader that everybody expects to win. So I think that it's going to make for an incredibly exciting event. And I think it's going to make for an event where anybody really has a shot to win.
Yesterday, the U.S. took 4 medals at the Winter Games, 1 in figure skating, 1 in skiing, and 2 in snowboarding, bringing the United States total to 18.
In Florida this morning, Tiger Woods takes center stage in his first public appearance since his sex scandal broke on Thanksgiving. The announcement will be carried live by major TV networks. But what are his fans thinking? New York golfer Matt Ragsdale reflected on Tiger's plight while teeing off at a driving range.
Does it change my opinion of him as a golfer? No. Does it change my opinion of him as a human being? Well, you know, yeah. It did, but whatever he has to say, I mean, he's just trying to put his life back together, same as anybody else would.
Tiger's announcement is expected at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. And finally, the latest U.N. appeal for donations for Haiti is the largest in its history. It wants nearly $1.5 billion. That's even more than it asked for the Asian tsunami. Former President Bill Clinton says there's an urgent need for tents, food, and water with the rainy season looming. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we have the latest details from Austin, Texas, where a small plane crashed into a building housing IRS workers. More on that in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Hey, Todd Zwillick here with Celeste. I'm filling in for John Hockenberry, of course. It's time for some takeouts on the stories we're following. First up,
it looked like the building exploding from the inside in a huge ball of fire. A debris was flying through the air. I was literally just mortified as I'm driving. I'm just looking at this building exploding.
That's Armando Gonzalez, a furniture salesman who witnessed the plane crash. Fellow Texan Joseph Andrew Stack allegedly flew a small plane into a building where the IRS houses about 200 workers. Joining us now with more is Ian Crawford, news editor for public radio station KUT in Austin, Texas. Ian, what is the latest information we have from the crash site there in Austin?
The latest thing we have, Todd, is that the FBI and the Austin Fire Department confirmed late last night that 2 bodies were found in the what was left of the Echelon building in Northwest Austin. No IDs on the bodies yet. There had been two people reported missing earlier in the day, one a federal employee, the other the pilot. People are extrapolating that one of the bodies found was the pilot, but again, nothing has been confirmed by local authorities yet.
And Ian Crawford from Takeaway member station KUT in Austin. What do we know about Joseph Andrew Stack and reports of an alleged confession, a screed on his website? I heard one quote that said, "Nothing changes unless there's a body count."
That's right. There was we printed out the note before the. Note was taken down off the website at apparently the request of the FBI. But one other quote that came from that, in fact, was in the opening line, was telling the IRS to take my pound of flesh and sleep well. It's a long, rambling diatribe lambasting the government, apparently admitting that he used several thousands of dollars in arrears in taxes to the IRS, and he signed the note, Joe Stack, and then in parentheses, the dates 1956 to 2010.
And already questions, of course, about whether or not this constitutes an act of terrorism. Ian Crawford from Takeaway member station KUT in Austin, thanks so much.
For our next take, we'll go back to Vancouver. Jason Stallman joins us again. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Jason, what is going on this Friday? People say it's kind of a light Friday, but we're going to see a sport many people didn't even know existed. It's called skeleton. What is it?
Well, you know, every 2 years, the Olympics seems to offer an international audience some sports that you really don't pay attention to except for when the Olympics are on. And that's certainly what's happening now at the Whistler sliding track up at 2 hours away from Vancouver in the mountains. This is the facility that is home to bobsled, skeleton, and luge, the daredevil thrill-seeker sports where they fly down the mountain on an icy chute. And the reason it's so compelling right now is because, as everyone knows, a luge athlete from Georgia died last week on this track. So many athletes who compete here say it's too dangerous. The speeds they're attaining are just too high. So now the luge competition is over, and we turn to skeleton and bobsled. The first night of bobsled training, there were 8 crashes. Last night, there were at least 3 more. A Swiss rider and an Australian rider were hospitalized, and they were held out of practice yesterday. So oddly, all eyes at the Whistler sliding track right now on bobsled and skeleton.
And is this a higher number of injuries than in normal Olympics?
You know, the officials are saying that at least for that first night of training on bobsled, that the 8 crashes was not out of the ordinary. We haven't been able to corroborate that, but one thing is for sure, that the speeds that they're attaining on this track are much higher than other tracks. It was expected, at least for luge, that the athletes would reach about 140, 145 kilometers an hour. They were about 10 to 15 over that, so they're going much faster here.
And so you have to wonder if they're going to have some kind of meeting of the minds later to discuss whether or not something is too fast when you're heading down an icy track in the Olympics.
That's the big question moving forward, and are they going to wait until after the Olympics to address this, or are they going to do something during? The luge competition, the course was changed. They made it shorter to diminish the speeds. Bobsled and skeleton officials so far have said they're not going to alter their course, so we'll see if the crashes continue.
Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks, Jason.
And for our last takeout now, we look back at the past 5 days with our friends from The Week magazine. Who had a good week and who had a bad week? First up, love really does stink, apparently, at least for one farm couple in Minnesota. For Valentine's Day, get this, wife Beth Andersland woke up to find a half-mile-wide heart drawn on her lawn in manure. Now, I know what you're she knows what you're thinking.
How can a design in a field made out of manure be anything special? But the manure is from cows, and I dearly love my cows. And manure is part of the package.
Beth says she loves her Valentine's Day gift, so what can we say except way to go, Mr. Andersland, for creativity. For that, you get the week's Good Week Award.
The Week magazine also has flying on their mind. Bad week for the cold. American Airlines announced it will now charge $8 for blankets. That's not the only reason it was a bad week for airline passengers. In our minds, we're thinking this week wasn't that great to be director Kevin Smith or Southwest Airlines.
I live my life fat, and I have to navigate through a thin person's world all the time. And as such, you would never put yourself into harm's way, so to speak, In regards to your girth or size.
That is director Kevin Smith on his podcast talking about Southwest Airlines. They booted him off a flight on Saturday since Smith wasn't able to, quote, comfortably lower the armrest, end quote. Because of his size, Southwest took him off the flight.
I guess that's the standard, but not a good week then for bigger people flying or for Southwest Airlines facing all the bad PR over this. But that's a good week. That's a good week and a bad week. What are your suggestions?
I'm Veronica from Oklahoma City, and I nominate my husband for the worst week. He's been unemployed since July and was working towards a job that he really wanted and did not get it after 4 months of process. I vote my husband.
Definitely a bad week for him, Veronica. Don't give up. Give us your suggestions from news or from your life. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to the site at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, since the start of the Afghan war, the U.S. has been trying to gain control of the country dominated by the Taliban. How well do we really understand our enemy? More on that in just a few minutes. I'm Todd Zwilligan for John Hockenberry, and I'm here with Celeste Headley. Coming up, since the start of the Afghan war, the U.S. has been fighting against the Taliban, of course, but how well do we really understand our enemy? We'll talk more about that in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top stories at 31 minutes after the hour. President Obama is sending $1.5 billion to the five states hardest hit by the housing crisis. Those five states are Arizona, California, Michigan, Florida, and Nevada. They've seen their home prices drop by 20% or more. The president will make the announcement in Las Vegas. Later this morning. Meanwhile, at the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, Americans are making a run at finishing the games with the most medals for the first time in 80 years. On tap today, ski jumping starts in a half an hour. There's also men's alpine skiing and hockey. Ice dancer Charlie White says Team USA is ready to dominate.
I think we have a very strong medal contending team. We've been out doing Grand Prix and at Nationals, I think showing the world what we're capable of and putting up great scores. So it's just a matter of how we skate here that'll put that to the test.
If you're counting the medals, the U.S. has 18 now after four more yesterday.
A bunch of economic numbers out this morning. To start, the cost of living in the U.S. when you take out food and gas fell for the first time in 27 years. Analysts believe the figures mean the Federal Reserve has more time to keep interest rates at their record low levels. Gas prices, though, are at their highest since August. And the Federal Reserve has decided to boost the rate banks pay for emergency loans. The move won't affect borrowing costs for ordinary Americans, only banks, and that goes into effect today. Markets are now open. The Dow is down about 26 points. The S&P is down about 3, and the NASDAQ down about 9 points. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Since the start of the Afghan war in Afghanistan in 2001, the U.S. has been trying to gain control of a country ruled and dominated by the Taliban. And with the fighting this week in Marja, our focus is more than ever on pushing the Taliban out.
The Taliban is clearly being squeezed. Being squeezed by our forces, coalition forces, Afghan forces in Afghanistan, being squeezed by Pakistani military and intelligence forces.
That's Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell trying to deliver some good news for the American military on the issue of the Taliban and Marja. But while the fighting is going on, how well do we really understand our enemies? And if we don't know what they want and how they're motivated, can we ever really be successful in Afghanistan? Joining us to talk about that is Alex Strick Van Linshoten, a researcher who lives in Kandahar, Afghanistan. And he and his partner translated a book called My Life with the Taliban, the autobiography of a senior member of Afghanistan's Taliban. Welcome.
Good morning.
Now, your book was written by a gentleman named Mullah Abdul Salim Zahif, and he's a former senior member of the Taliban. It was originally written in Pashtun. You did a cultural translation, not a direct translation of this book, after hours, dozens, if not hundreds of hours of interviews, if I'm not mistaken. After all of these interviews, what do you think we need to know first and foremost about the Taliban?
I mean, the first thing, I guess, is that the Taliban are a very different group of people, and certainly this idea of understanding and our lack of understanding is pretty important. We're 9 years into a conflict, and some of the very basic things about the people in southern Afghanistan we still have very little idea about.
What do you think that we're missing primarily? If there's a couple of things about the Taliban that we are missing that you think might be impeding our progress there in winning over the people who they say they're fighting for?
In terms of the Taliban movement, one important thing is the strong local basis to the movement. Often when we talk about the Taliban, people want to to say that it's fueled by Pakistan. It's an outside creation. These are outsiders from the Afghan country, whereas in fact it's not. It was a local movement in inception. It has a very long history, particularly in the 1980s war against the Soviet Union. And we have to remember all of these kind of very local and indigenous elements to the Taliban movement, particularly when we're talking about southern Afghanistan.
So the fact that they're homegrown, truly a grassroots movement, even if we don't want to believe it, they are a grassroots group in Afghanistan. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And this goes to then this discussion which we have at the moment about whether we should be talking with the Taliban.
Right.
If we assume that they're a foreign movement, then perhaps we don't need to, because, you know, it's just a question of expelling them out of the country. But given that there's such a strong local basis for these people, that feeds into that discussion.
Well, you mentioned whether we should be talking to them, and that's an issue that's going to come up. There are apparently talks been going on between the Taliban and the Afghan government in the Maldives. That's what we understand this week. But as we decide whether we negotiate with them or not, are the Taliban people who would negotiate with us? You know, we make this distinction, or we should anyway, between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, we say we're going to capture or kill. The Taliban different? What would we think if we found them across the table from us?
Sitting across the table from you is quite a different experience from talking about negotiations between groups on a one-on-one basis. As I discovered while writing this book, you can have perfectly fine relationships and trust and so on. But in terms of movement, in terms of what the Taliban think, they don't really feel that they can trust either the foreigners or the Afghan government itself. The Afghan government isn't seen as a legitimate negotiating partner by the Taliban.
Does that mean that any endgame is useless? I mean, if they have no inherent trust for the Afghan government or for us, that might mean that they choose just to fight to the death. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it.
There's certainly an element of that, but Afghans have always been very pragmatic people, and in the end, the solution which we're going to have in Afghanistan is a political solution. It's not a military solution.
You know, Todd's alluded to this. Very often Americans make the mistake of lumping the Taliban together with Al-Qaeda fighters and thinking of them both as terrorist groups. But there's very different motivations for these true groups, right? What pushes the Taliban to keep fighting?
The Taliban, I mean, it's we use one word for it, but it's a group with an incredibly diverse background of people. You have some people who are fighting for ideological reasons, maybe who are closer to what we call Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. We have other people who are fighting because out of economic reasons. You have other people who are fighting simply because for the kind of camaraderie of the trench and because they're young and bored and in the villages. You have people who are forced out and alienated by the local government, which is quite predatory.
And religious reasons too.
Yes, I mean that goes to the kind of ideological thing. But I think we tend in the West to overplay the religious element. For the Taliban, it's they talk a lot about religion, but once you look a bit beyond that, it's not so important as a motivating factor.
So, Alex Strick Van Linshouten, I'm interested in your prognosis, knowing what you know about the people in Afghanistan, let's say in Marja, but across Afghanistan more broadly, and what you know about the enemy, in this case, the Taliban. What's your prognosis for this 9-year effort so far?
So far, I mean, we are where we are. We've been trying.
Where are we going, I guess, is my question.
We're looking at more of the same, I have to say. The things that need to change in terms of a wider strategy, I don't think we've seen that top-level change yet.
What about Stanley McChrystal's schools in a box, government in a box, get the Taliban out, put civil and social institutions in? Does that have any traction from what you know about the Taliban and the Afghans?
Possibly, but our fundamental problem is that we're working together with the Afghan government, who have very little legitimacy in the eyes of the Afghan people. And every time we go into a place and then we put the Afghan government there, the government are going to mess it up, more or less.
Well, it's all very complicated, but we're grateful for your insights. That's Alex Strick Van Linshouten, a researcher who lives in Kandahar and has helped translate and write a book, My Life with the Taliban. It's an autobiography of a senior member of Afghanistan's Taliban. Alex, thanks for joining us.
This morning we're talking about movies, and we're asking you, we're talking about sports movies, but in any movie, is there a movie that you went in thinking you would hate it and you came out loving it?
This is Gretchen in Boston. My favorite sports movie for a non-sports lover would be...
Et maintenant, sur scène, les triplettes de Belleville.
The Triplets of Belleville, which I see as being about the Tour de France, but not really about the Tour de France.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can put it on our website, thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. The assassination of a Hamas official, Mahmoud Al-Mahou, last month in a Dubai hotel room has been compared to the plot of a cheap spy novel with a cast of suspects who were klutzy, if nothing else, forged passports, fake beards, fake mustaches, floppy hats. So as the investigation of Mahou's murder reveals more and more real-life espionage cliches, we're consulting an expert in spy plots, fictional ones anyway, to discuss the literary merits of the crime. Novelist Olin Steinhauer joins us today. Olin's written six thrillers, including The Tourist. It's out in paperback this week. Good morning, Olin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. You know, I've heard newscasters even saying that if this plot were used in a modern spy novel, it would be criticized as cliche and totally unbelievable. What do you think?
Well, I was looking at it when it first came out. A friend of mine, Kevin Wignall, directed my attention to it. And my thought was actually it would be brilliant. But if it's not Mossad, in spy fiction, things are seldom as straightforward as they seem in the news, and in this case, it would be much more interesting if, say, it was Hamas doing the hit because of some internal power struggle. Make it look like Mossad did it, and they save face while getting rid of someone, and they know Mossad's never going to say they didn't do it.
So the classic bait and switch there, but we know lots about bank robberies or casino robberies that involve a large group of guys. But would you ever plot 11 men to commit a murder?
Well, I think in reality, as opposed to spy fiction, it takes a few more people than you naturally think to get rid of someone. In this case, they had different people taking care of getting the keys, setting up the surveillance. And, before the age of satellites, you would regularly have a very large team just to follow one person so that no one noticed they were being followed.
So you're actually writing your next novel right now.
Yes, I am.
And you've already written about a murder in a hotel room.
That's right.
What would you borrow from this case? Is there anything you would take away?
Well, that's what I've been trying to think about. I wake up early to write, and this has been moving around in my head. And I like the idea of it being so many people, because that's not the sort of thing you would see in fiction. And I think I think probably I am going to take a few details from it. I like the fact that the security cameras watch them go in the room and then appear again a while later. That's sort of a nicely cinematic thing that I think would work really well in a novel as well.
What would you not take? The floppy hat?
The floppy hats. I don't know about those. I mean, the thing that's strange to me about that is that I see these, and we have pretty clear pictures of their faces. I don't know what that was really supposed to accomplish.
I guess nobody really knows. Olin Steinhauer, author of The Tourist and five other thrillers, maybe a floppy hat appearing in a thriller on bookshelves now. He's author of The Tourist. It appears in paperback this week. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John Hockenberry this week. Coming up, Malcolm X was assassinated 45 years ago this Sunday, and we're going to take a look back at his legacy through some rediscovered tape from the WNYC archives that hasn't been heard since the early 1960s. It's coming in a few moments. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. NATO forces in Afghanistan say six of their soldiers were killed yesterday in the Marja offensive. Meanwhile, the Afghan defense minister tells our partner, the BBC, the Afghan forces are taking the lead in the fight against the Taliban there.
Physically on the battlefield, we are ahead of the Allied forces in the operation.
In Iraq, the U.S. military mission will soon get a new name. As of September, Operation Iraqi Freedom will be called Operation New Dawn. The military says it'll send a strong signal that Iraq is being returned to the Iraqi people.
In Vancouver yesterday, the U.S. took four more medals, including a gold in men's figure skating, bringing the American total to 18 medals. Finally, consumer prices, if you don't count food and energy, fell in January for the first time in 27 years. Overall prices edged up 0.2%. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
45 years ago this weekend, civil rights leader Malcolm X was assassinated. And just a few months ago, our home station WNYC Radio unearthed tape of Malcolm X speaking in an interview in the early 1960s with WNYC journalist Eleanor Fisher. On this somber anniversary, we want to consider Malcolm X's legacy, not just through this rediscovered tape, but through two people whose lives were profoundly affected by him. Earl Grant was a close associate of Malcolm X and one of the last people to see him alive. Peter Bailey is a former associate editor for Ebony Magazine and an original member of Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity. Mr. Grant, let's start with the big question that I guess a lot of people ask now is what do you think is the legacy of Malcolm X?
Well, he was primarily concerned about seeing the world the way it actually is, not the way people believe in it. And he stressed all the time that we have to be informed about whatever we're doing. He told us there'd never been an ignorant revolution, and there never would be one. It's always about information.
Which has ended up to being frighteningly accurate. You know, I was not alive during Malcolm X's lifetime. All I know of him is what I've read in books, my history texts. I wonder if you can kind of flesh out his biography for me. I mean, what kind of a person was he?
Well, he was like your vision of a grandfather, very sweet, loving person. He wasn't always this person with his fists clenched and his teeth showing. That's the image that the press presented of him. But there were other images of him they never did try to present.
Peter Bailey, you weren't a close associate of Malcolm X, but you've called him your master teacher. What do you mean by that? What did you learn from him?
He provided me with a perspective on how to view the country and the world. That was his most important thing to me. He also taught me how to use language. I described 1964, the policeman who killed that young boy, as a murderer. And he told me, no, you can't use a murderer, because those are legal terms. Call him a killer and refer to it as a killing, because it's a killing, and he's a killer, and it's a killing no matter what the circumstances. And that policeman later sued SCLC and CORE. So it was those kinds of things, how to look at the world. I'm a journalist because of him. He stressed the importance of the gathering and distribution of information and led me into journalism. I had never even thought about journalism until I got involved with him.
I want to play you a clip from an interview he did with WNYC reporter Eleanor Fleischer in the early 1960s, kind of giving us insight into how he framed his ideas.
You think the Negro has first to raise himself to a status of equality with the white community.
Yes.
Now, what happens, assuming that he can do that, would you then be in favor of integration, let's say, in the schools or anyplace else?
When you are equal with another person, the problem of integration doesn't even arise. The only minority in America that's asking for integration is the so-called Negro, primarily because he is inferior, not inherently inferior, but he's economically, socially, politically inferior, and this exists because he has never tried to stand on his own two feet and do something for himself. He has filled the role of a beggar.
Mr. Grant, first of all, the power of hearing his voice is amazing. After 45 years, even longer, this was done in the early 1960s. But he never shied away from these very controversial stances.
No, one of his favorite statements was, tell it like it is. He lived in a real world at all times. He said, brother, no matter how much time you stand around hallucinating, reality is all around you.
You know, we now celebrate civil rights through Martin Luther King Day, and we actually have a piece of tape from this interview in which Malcolm X was talking about Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King has made the Negro in America unnatural. He has taken away from the Negro his God-given right to defend himself. He has them going through. I looked on the television the other night and saw them beating a Negro unmercifully in Mississippi. And this is the result of a brainwashing technique that a certain power structure in the American government has paid these Negro integrationist leaders to perpetuate among our people.
Such a passionate man. And Peter, I'm wondering, you know, too often now Martin Luther King is seen as the symbol for the entire civil rights movement, but Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were both working toward the same goal in very different ways.
I think you have to understand that during the latter year, during the time that I was involved with Brother Malcolm, he had his relationship with Dr. King had improved considerably.
Come full circle.
Had improved considerably, and he respected Dr. King. I don't know if they ever would have been bosom buddies, but I think they had developed a tremendous amount of respect for each other. In fact, in Anthony Summers' book on J. Edgar Hoover, there's a quote by J. Edgar Hoover in which he is speaking to then-Senator Lyndon Johnson, and he says, if we could get those two guys fighting each other to kill one another off. And the two guys he was talking about was Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. So, you know, J. Edgar Hoover recognized that a combination of these two men working together could have caused him some nightmares. And so I think that what he said about Dr. King at that time, because he believed in self-defense. That's what he was really saying. I tell people all the time, if you ever find a thing where Brother Malcolm advocated black people going out and shooting people, that's not true. It was always in the context of self-defense. And he believed in that. He believed strongly that people had a right to defend themselves. And if you read Martin Luther King's book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos Our Community, you'll see a different Martin Luther King than the I Have a Dream that he's been reduced to.
They
and
both
I mean
changed.
Reduced to.
Yeah, they both changed.
Yes.
Earl Grant, I'm wondering, do we have, as we look at our textbooks today, are we seeing the civil rights movement through maybe simplistic eyes? We're not seeing all these variations of opinion and debate?
I think you certainly are. What Malcolm was always trying to do was to get us to, if you're born in this country, grew up in this country, how come you don't think like an American? And Americans don't do any of that nonviolent stuff. That's not this country. So how could you have been in this country, learned about Washington, Patrick Henry? They taught me all this stuff in school. Then you come out and stand on the corner and talk about you're nonviolent. Doesn't make sense. That's unnatural.
And that's what he was talking about in that particular clip.
Yeah.
And we have one more clip for you.
He's already separate. The fact that he's a second-class citizen is a political separation. The fact that he's the last hired and the first fired is an economic separation. Only in this form of separation, the black man is exploited.
In the last minute here, Peter Bailey, that separation he's talking about for the black man, it still hasn't been fixed.
Yes, I mean, he was basically saying that separation. Brother Malcolm was a very, very intelligent person. So he would not take positions that were ludicrous. He meant that if you separate yourself to build yourself up, doesn't mean you escape from the world. You know, people, they try to present it as though he was saying we could somehow escape from the world. But he was not. And when you hear him speak, you have to put it in the context of the times, 1955, 1965, the height of the civil rights movement. What happened during that time? Emmett Till was lynched. The little girls were killed in Birmingham. Medgar Evers was assassinated. I mean, that was terrorism in this country at that time. And his speeches and things were responding to rampant, unpunished, and that's the key word, unpunished terrorism.
Peter Bailey, former associate editor of Ebony Magazine and original member of the Organization for Afro-American Unity, and Earl Grant, close associate of Malcolm X and one of the last to see him alive. You can hear the entire interview about Malcolm X and the entire interview between Malcolm X and WNYC journalist Eleanor Fisher from the 60s on our website, thetakeaway.org.
While you're there, we have a special feature for all you non-sports fanatics out there. We're talking about the best sports movies for sports haters, and you can give suggestions and get suggestions and even vote on the best one. That's on our site, thetakeaway.org. What's a sports film you thought you would hate and now you have come to love?
My name is Marsha Davis. I'm from Florence, South Carolina. And the one movie that I thought I wouldn't like, but I did, is it's an old movie. It's called The Air Up There.
I'm a Jimmy Dolan chicken bacon.
And it is shot in Africa. That is a great sports movie.
Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to the website and post thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. And for John Hockenberry, it's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.